Question number 9963.
Mr. Brewer, no. Relight.
Various groups then were put onto these lorries. And then there was one of those amazing interruptions in war. There was a tall, very attractive blonde woman dressed in the military uniform, breeches and high boots, beautifully laundered shirt, and she had gone mad. And she was dashing around, screaming at the men, and she wanted to lead us forward and all the rest of it. And she was quite hysterical. And no one there seemed to take on the authority to ask her to be quiet, give her something to do, and get her out of the way, because it was quite demoralising.
Who was she?
I've no idea, but she would be one of the female. She might have been a Russian, she might have been a Spaniard.
What language was she speaking in?
In Spanish. But she wasn't, I don't think, she definitely wasn't a Spaniard. And eventually, I don't know, one truckload of men took pity on her and hauled her aboard and then put her in the front to do her shouting and raving. And off they went up the road. Well, the group that I was with now, we were a few Britons, a few Frenchmen, I suppose, some Germans. And we came to this point at Batia now, and there, to our amazement, was a troop of Bofors guns in immaculate condition. And there were soldiers around the battery. These were, whatever nationality they were in uniform. And clearly they were regular soldiers of some sort or another, of some army. And there were a couple of generals there. And, oh God, they were bad-tempered. And the senior of them was speaking in French and exhorting the troops to go forward, and he wasn't very careful in his choice of language. And I knew a few words, disparaging words in French, and the French word for dog, canne, eh?
Chien.
No, the plural. I think it's C-A-N-A-I-L-L-E.
Canai.
And there he was shouting, "Can I go forward?" And I thought, by God, if these chaps understood that you were referred to as dogs, they'd probably bloody shoot you. And everything on this gun site was marvellous. There was a cookhouse and large metal containers full of coffee with milk and all the rest of it. And now they must have got some report. And we sat there now and we waited for someone to impose a bit of order. We just weren't going to go casually into this unless somebody knew where we were going, why and how. And suddenly these guns had disappeared, been pulled back. But they were in such a damned hurry that they left this kitchen behind. So we fell on it like wolves. And there were a lot of beakers of one sort and another lying around. We grabbed them and we sat down and regaled ourselves with better coffee than we had had for God knows how long. And then someone came along of lower authority, and we got ourselves formed up in some sort of order, and we marched forward to establish a line. And they decided that we'd all have to pull back. Now, I've gone ahead of this, but we'd have to pull back across the river, which we did in good order. And now, when we recrossed the Ebro, then, it was very well done. They had boats there. They'd apparently got hold of some chaps who would be trained as in the SAS style, as it was in those days. And they had gone across and silenced the enemy output. So the crossings were uninterrupted. And we just went up the Ebro Valley then in columns of companies, you see. And the enemy were a long way off. So it was an unopposed crossing. Well, now the recent pronouncements from one of our chaps in North Wales, Tom Jones, was made, got done rather well out of being in Spain, became a trade union official and so on, and he's got to the stage now where he's using other men's words, where he's read books about actions that he knew nothing about and projects himself into it. Now, he should, he was in the anti-tank battery, and he should, with me and a few others, been posted to the infantry. But we never saw him again until many years after the war. But now he claims that there was a machine gun group with heavy machine guns, supposed to be heavier than the Maxim. This I find difficult to believe. And their job was to, they were lined up behind us crossing the Ebro, and after we'd got across the Ebro, and their job now was, if we came up against enemy opposition and we withdrew or retreated, this crowd that he was in were to shoot, to mow us down. Now, when he told me this fanciful tale, I said, my God, I said, if we had known, if there was such a unit, I said, then we would have known, and we knew that, we would have turned about and we'd have damn well obliterated you. So I said, you know, don't tell that story too often, because someone might become very angry, because there was no pressure on us at all. We had as much determination to get across that river as anybody in the high command, and we weren't demoralised, we were ready to have a go. But now what is appalling is that he told this story of his in the programme that was broadcast on Welsh TV last year on the 50th anniversary, and I was extremely angry about it, and I told the lad who did this recording, I said, that's a damned lie. And I said, if there was such a machine gun company, it had one purpose only, to defend divisional or corps headquarters. Not from us, I said, but from the enemy. And there are so many people romanticising, you see, and building up their reputations, whose service, actual service in the line, was like this fellow I told you, this Jack Roberts from the Rumney Valley, who was in the war against fascism, whose service was trifling, 27 days. God knows how many millions of men, women and children killed. And that fellow only saw 27 days of it at the beginning. And then they tried to make a hero out of him. And he was a nothing, in battle or out of it. But the then you get the other fellows, the disillusioned fellows, like Jason Gurney, who wrote The Last Crusade, and a few others. You get claims made that we were all communists by Judith Cook, and they just don't accept the fact that a lot of us knew why we were there, that we had an inkling of what was ahead, and that we hoped that the nations would get together, support the Republic, and keep Adolf and Mussolini in their place. But it was a vain hope. Well, We had this terrible series of actions. I found myself posted to the machine gun company up on the Pandals then. And two guns out of the three in the company were wiped out because this company commander insisted on putting... It was a position where I was first put in by Fletcher and where I was put in charge of the gun. We swapped over to the middle position. The middle position went to our gun position. We'd done some firing. Our position was known to the enemy. And they put some howitzers on the hill and plonk. One machine gun team wiped out. There was one survivor, an Irishman, a friend of mine, Alec Diggs, and he was badly shocked when he came to and found that he was the only survivor. Well, now the third gun team was put into that same position. They lasted a day. And on the next day now, the McNulty ordered us to prepare to move. And fortunately for us, George Fletcher came up. He was now the battalion commander. And he said, where are these men going to? He said, I'm going to put them in that one position over there. And he said, what the hell are you about? Are you more concerned to wipe this company out than you are to bring fire to bear on the enemy? These men stay here. And he ignored him and he said, no, lads, stay in this gun position. No smoking. No movement. And if you've got to get out, use the communication trench, which is there, so that you're out of sight of the enemy. And he said, you don't fire until you get orders from me. And we stayed there that whole day. Now, there were two twins, the Bennett brothers from Liverpool, and one had been killed on the first gun team, and his brother was in my team. And the poor chap cracked up his grief now over his brother. Imagine losing a twin brother and having to keep still in this terrible heat and so on. And he turned on me and, good God, I was responsible for the whole war. I was responsible for his brother being killed. He let off steam, but I didn't mind. I thought, well, hell, if I was in his position, how would I feel? And he went off from through this communication trench and he probably sobbed his heart out of sight. And he came back a couple of hours later and one of the boys had some cigarettes, so I said, give him a cigarette. And so I said, no, go back around there now, I said. And we gave him two cigarettes, go and have a quiet smoke and then come back. But when he came back, he was right as rain. And I never saw him until we had a big reunion in Manchester, and he was across the room. And he recognised me before I recognised him. And he came across, and I went to meet him, and we shook hands. And it was as if all the years fell away. And everyone I met there, with whom I'd served on as a rifleman, or a machine gunner, or in the anti-tank battery, we were straight away back on the same old terms. And glad that we were still alive and were seeing each other. Now the next thing that happened now was that we were being withdrawn under the auspices of the League of Nations, the Non-Intervention Committee. So we were pulled out of the line. And various ceremonies took place when we left the division and so on. We left the army, we left the division, we left the brigade. And we had parades. And finally, we were told now that there would be a farewell parade in Barcelona. And we went along. We were standing there now on the diagonal, formed up. And the British had been given the right of the line. So we were at the head of the parade. And George, there were a couple of banners there. And now finally George Fletcher had had to go up with the other battalion commanders of the battalions, and we were given the battle honours, which had been embroidered for us by some association of women in Barcelona. Beautiful banners with all the battle honours on them, see, and the name of the battalion. And so George came along now, and he trooped this colour now through the ranks, and he came up to me and he said, right, take this staff, take charge and make a good job of it. And remember, he said, when you get to the presidential stand, you lower it in salute at the march past. Right, I said. So I stepped out of the ranks now and marched forward to where the other two colours were. And there were Alan Menai Williams, a fellow Welshman, who'd been through the whole damn thing, a lot, even earlier than I was there, as a medical orderly to the battalion. And a chap, John Scott Pete, who was whom I liked, you know, quite good friends. And I don't think he'd been there as long as either of us. So we formed up in a line abreast now at the head of the column, and we were the first soldiers of the International Brigade, because in front of us were the Presidential Guard of the Guardia Salto, and in front of them the band of the Guardia Salto. This was the sort of close protection squad of the presidency. And so they struck up now, and we get the, though I've never seen it in the British Army, but they had some ceremonial march, and they were going at the pace, if you followed the drums, the bugles and drums and whatnot, your pace was equal to the forced march of the Yorkshire Light Infantry, and they can damn well move. But of course these chaps weren't marching straight forward. They were marching and counter-marching behind this band, you see, in the marvellous uniforms and all that. And I thought, good God, if we take our pace from the band and march straight forward, we'll be through them and we'll be through the band, and the band will be flung on one side. So I said, right, slow down, boys. I said, British artillery pace. Halfway, I said, between the light infantry and the artillery slow march. In other words, I said, march as we're accustomed to. And so I shouted out, now, left, right, and we stuck to that pace, you see. Well, now, it was fantastic, because now the band was ahead of us by about 50 yards, which was all right. And the diagonal was covered with roses. And being a keen horticulturalist, fond of flowers, it was horrible to me to have to march over flowers. But we had to do it. And so I glanced to my left now, and there was a banner, an Eastern long banner, the Chinese fashion, with this foreign what's name on it, you see, called
Wettering.
Yeah. And I told Alan, I said, look to your left, Alan. And he looked, and he said, where the hell has he come from? And he was an Easterner. And I tried to find out from Nan Green who this chap could have been, because we had no Easterners in our ranks at all. We did have one Indian from Cardiff, who died out in Spain, Ramadesis. But he was the only one that I knew of any sort of Eastern aspect at all. And I said, no, there's something wrong here. And subsequently I asked Nan Green, who did she think it was? And she said, well, it was probably Ho Chi Minh or one of his friends, because they were in France at the time. And So I said, okay, I'm not having this. So I said, I'm going to go forward now 4 paces. You maintain your position relative to me and make sure that that chap doesn't come up on my left hand, I said, because I'll have to order him to go further back or get off the parade. So I was left now, the ensign of the battalion, ensign of the whole damn international brigade, heading the parade. No officers were in front of me because they were all back of the battalions. And I began to feel very self-conscious, especially now because some of these young women couldn't restrain themselves. And one burst through the cordon of police and soldiers on the side. And she came up to me and kissed me. And then she put the flag, she held the flag to the baby's lips. And I thought, oh hell, this is going to be difficult, because in those days for a Spanish woman to kiss anybody in public was unknown. And then a number of brave spirits, female spirits, broke the cordon and dashed out to sea. They came to kiss me or to kiss the flag. And I was determined to, nothing was going to stop me except an assassin's bullet. So eventually they left us in peace. And they were attacking the column behind us now, these girls coming out. And it was a very poignant moment, you know, because you were thinking now of the chaps who wouldn't be coming back and all the battles that you'd been in. And then there was the bloody shame of leaving the Spanish people in that situation, while these Hitler and Adolf were allowed to pour in whatever they wanted. And that feeling was very strong in me that day, because you had time to think. You were observing this steady pace, you see, holding this banner against the wind. And then when we came to the presidential stand, I shouted to the lads behind me, get ready. And I said, salute. And we lowered the four banners simultaneously and marched past. And all the big shots were there, then the army commanders, Negrín, the president, and so on. And that was the end of our effective service. But for one thing that occurred now, while we were before this and while we were out of the line, all the people now who had spent the war, the 2 years of the war, in nice jobs in the rear, came up to join us. We were going home. And we hadn't seen them for a year or 18 months. And we still had our arms. We hadn't surrendered our arms. But now we were shortly going to do so, and then we were going to be drawn out of the line and so on. And midnight, the whistle went for stand two. And we stood to, got our equipment, and Sam Wild came along and he said that we had to go into the line because the Tailman Battalion had taken a bashing on that particular day, and we had to hold the line. And we went in, and my God, we had a day of it. And probably the most incongruous moment that I ever experienced in war, the machine gun company commander, this damn madman, showed me my gun position, which was up on a ridge, dug in, nice firing platform, communication trench, logs on top, sandbags, and camouflage. Cut down branches from olive trees. And, of course, all the leaves had withered, so it stuck out like a sore thumb. And I looked around now, and this machine gun commander was with us. And I nudged my number two. I lifted the barrel up. He put the carriage, put the gun on, turned it round, estimated the range. And I said, "Load." And this commander said, "What do you think you're doing?" And I said, "Down there are some enemy soldiers shaving," I said. "Can you see them? There are about 20 of them." And I said, "What I'm going to do is to give them breakfast." "No, you don't," he said. "You don't fire until the battle starts." And I thought, good God, here we are back now before Agincourt. We are really back in the old days when the commanders would say, right, the battle will commence at such and such an hour. And there were those buggers who were going to kill our chaps shaving. I knew our chaps weren't shaving because they'd only just got into the line. And I said then, well, I said to myself, that's the last order I take from you. If I survive, this gun team is my responsibility and I'm going to see them through. Well, the battle began now with a barrage from the enemy. And the first lot of shells, there was one. Now, it may have been an 88 millimetre or it may have been a 75. But he was bang on. Took some of the logs, landed right on top of our machine gun post. So we commenced firing now, and the only damn direction to fire was you must shoot over that hill there. Utterly farcical. And this chap had gone off now, leading the machine gun team down to some other position. This gun reloaded, second shell. He was short. Then I sort of, it was instinct then, how long it would take him to reload, line up the gun and fire. Well, he fired four rounds, each one of which hit this machine gun post. And something made me say, shout down. And I got down, and I was daft enough, I'd left, still had my hands up, holding the trigger guard of this machine gun. And the damn thing came whoop under the barrel. So I had to struggle then now against the blast to push the gun up, otherwise it had been over on top of us. And the machine gun pit was black with cordite. We all had our faces black with all this explosive. And I looked at the gun and the barrel was peppered. Water was pouring out. And I said, right, boys, you've had it. Now, I said, we'll go up this hill. I said, I've got a rough idea that battalion headquarters and George Fletcher are up higher on the ridge. And I said, if you want to survive now, move by order. Because I said, you're machine gunners, and you know that that chap has got to